car. Well, guess what? I've got some recipes. Well, I also have some more stuff. Hi there, and thanks for listening. This is Conscious Living, and I have a guest today who has fabulously agreed to share with us some of her memories from being an A-list literary agent and having connections with the who's who laundry list of people who were up and coming in the New Age arena before it was actually called New Age. All right, so this is going to be fun. Snapshots, memories, and recipes. My guest, Sandra Martin, also decided that, you know, it might be good to throw in some really good recipes. And so on that happy note, I will say that we'll share one after we get going, all right? And it's a good thing to share. But just to give you an example, some of them have a theme. There's the Holy Shifts recipe, apple, walnut, and avocado salad. Hey, Sandra, I'm hungry.
And every time I open my book, I go, oh, maybe I'll take that. I think I could make that one today.
Okay, well, I will tell you, your cake is fabulous. When we spoke before, if you haven't heard my other interview with Sandra, I did this for Wendy's Coffee House. We spoke before, and then there was this cake that I wanted to try perfectly because it was her daughter's favorite birthday cake. She made it for her, like, when she was 3, 7, 6, somewhere in there, when she was a youngster. And the daughter says, Okay, this is my birthday cake from now until ever. And I'm a pie. Yeah, I wanted lemon meringue pie for mine. But I just said, you know, this is way too good. So we made Grandma Maud's orange chiffon cake. All right. Now, there's a story behind this. We're not going to get into that just yet. But anyway, that cake is magnificent. So just giving a slam dunk thumbs up on that. Thank you, Sandra.
You're welcome. Lisa enjoyed it for her birthday this year, too.
Yeah. And once we figured it out, it's like, you know, you could add a few other flavors to it and this will be fabulous. We'll get into the details on that later. But I just wanted to give you a chance here to talk about what you went through trying to remember, you know, the best of your literary hits for telling your stories, because there's some really fun ones in here that you just I didn't expect. And they're, what of all the stories that you wrote, is there a favorite, a standout?
Actually, you know, I think that I liked them all, obviously, but I was thinking after I wrote the book, and I have been keeping a journal or keeping journals since I was very young. Well, not all that young, but after I got my first divorce, I started keeping journals. So I was 30. But anyway, I've been keeping a journal since then, and I just wrote down everything that I did every night. It was sort of my therapy for, you know, going through things. And when I started to go back and write some of these stories, I wanted to make sure that I had the information right and the date right, or, you know, whatever I was using. So I was reading them, and I was so amazed. There were so many people that I had reached out to when I first moved to New York City. And one of them was a man named Michael Grosso, who has written many books. And the one that he wrote then, oh my God, I have this problem all the time when I'm trying to think of something that was about near death. It was called The Final Choice. And it was so extraordinary. And he was the only person, the only writer until I represented Yvonne Singh that I actually had to go and see, because that book so moved me and so spoke to me where I was at that time. And he is was a philosophy professor. He's retired now, and he lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. But at that time, he lived in upstate New York. And I guess, you know, you don't get many hardcore fans then. Yeah. But I called him up, and I just said, oh, my God, this is the best book. I just love this book. And then, of course, you know, I started reading it to him, which, you know, really wasn't appropriate, but anyhow. So he was but I said, oh, I'm going to be in New York, and I really, really want to see you, and it would be great, and all of this. And so he agreed to meet with me, and it was so funny. It was just when I was very, very in the very beginning of starting, and when I was, you know, feeling my way around and trying to figure out what was right and what was wrong. But books had so influenced everything in my life. It was sort of a natural that I became a literary agent. But I was staying all the way downtown near the Bowery, near where Ingo lived. And I knew Ingo, but I wasn't staying with him as an aside. I was staying at this guy's apartment that had, I was working at WHRO before this, and this man had called the office, and he wanted to create a program about Thomas Jefferson, because he looked like Thomas Jefferson, I guess. But he was professor of biology in Massachusetts at a university there, I think Boston U. And so he said he wanted to come to Virginia to talk to us, because that's what I did. I put together funding. So he said, I'll come down and, you know, where should I stay? And I said, oh, you can stay here at my house. And he was like, no, really. No, I said, that's okay. He said, you're only going to be here for a short time and we can talk. And then, you know. So he came and he talked about what he wanted to do. And his name was Tobin Bell, I think. But he really wanted to be an actor. That was his whole life stream. He wanted to be an actor. And but so he slept on my sofa. And he just kept saying, so this is what people in the South are like, huh? This is what people in the South are like. I've never, ever been to anybody's house that I never even saw before. Just talked on the phone. They invite me to spend the night. Oh, my God. And it was really funny, but he was a really cool guy. So he said, when you come to New York, you can stay in my apartment. And of course, his apartment was about as big as a closet. So he went and stayed with his girlfriend, and I stayed in his apartment. So Michael Grosso took, I think, 5 trains, all the, you know, from up past Manhattan and the Bronx and all of that. Finally, he got down to where I was. He said it took him over an hour and 45 minutes to get there. But we talked for like 4 hours about his book and philosophy and science and, you know, the meaning of life and how it all comes together. It was just so amazing that, you know, I had the opportunity to even do that. And he wrote a book about Padre Pio, and then he wrote a book about the priest that floated above the floated off the floor all the time.
The levitation, yes.
Yeah, levitation.
Oh, somebody had called me about doing that one. Oh, yes, and I put it. You know, I've got so much stuff; it's on the back burner. But yes, and I can't remember even my contact with that. But yes, and that sounded fascinating.
Yes, because it's a really, really good book, and he is just a great guy. But because of those kinds of things and being in Virginia Beach, all the speakers came to ARE or the Fellowship of the Inner Light or the Spiritual Frontiers Group. There were always speakers down there. And because it was a small world, you know, you just talked to everybody. It was everybody was right there. Richard Bach, everybody that came in was, you know, like first name kind of thing. But anyway, Michael Grosso eventually retired and moved to Charlottesville, but he was one of the first people that in this field that his book, Final Choice, made so much sense to me because he brought together so many different aspects of it. And I think that is what makes it rich and wonderful, which brings me to the one.
One quick question. Quick question. There's another book out that by him, and it's Experiencing the Next World Now. This is from 2004.
Yeah, that's an old book. I actually published that book. That was one of the books I published.
It said Paraview, and I'm thinking that's got to be your imprint.
Yeah, it is. But his newest book is, I don't know, something, a levitation. I could actually just walk in the other room and read it to you, but he's really an extraordinary guy. But one of the things that I liked about him, and you said, who did I like when I was, the things that I was doing at this time, were I liked the authors that were so well-rounded in their understanding, from the philosophy part to the science part to understanding the compassion and the mystical part. And, you know, there are very few people, researchers or writers or of any type, really, because people sort of focus on whatever they're focusing on. And I don't know if they get caught in that, this is who I am, or they just don't adventure out of that. but there are very few that do. But one of the ones that I thought was so great was that, and was so unexpected, was that John Cleese was like that. He was like that. He knew from A to Z on the subjects of what was going on and who was saying what and what was meaningful and what wasn't. And he was had so much wisdom. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah. Hold on a second, because that's the one we want to get into in just a minute. But Michael Grosso, the man who could fly, St. Joseph of Cupertino.
Yeah, that's right.
I wanted to look it up while we were talking about it because Peter Michael Langvin, he's been associated with the Monroe Group and the Monroe Institute, and he had contacted me about Michael, and I'm like, I've got so much to do. Let me get back to you. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, brain refresh here on this one. But you also talk in your book about the little experience you had with a tiny restaurant, a lovely place to eat, and John Cleese deciding that you had supernatural powers, kind of, and asking for an assist. And that's a great story. I love that one.
I know. He was. We had been talking so many times about, because he lived in Santa Barbara then, and I was, on the East Coast, and we would talk about different ways of presenting. This is why I know he knew so much about it. Different ways of presenting the material and different ways of weaving it together. And his concept was that he wanted to do a series, Spirituality for Every Man, for the Every Man. And because he really believed that we were all on the search, which I do too, that even if we're not aware of it, we are trying to make sense of why we're here and what it means and a deeper level of, who we are.
Yeah.
And so we would talk and talk, and we kept missing each other, but finally, we would chat. And then he wanted to get together when I was in New York. And so Diane, who I had been working with, wanted to make a reservation in a really high-end, upscale, the end place. And he had said, let's eat at Barney's, which was near where he was staying and a comfort zone, I'm sure, for him. But he was very gracious. And I was going, well, maybe we should go. And she was like, oh, no, let's impress him. I was thinking, oh, dear. But anyhow, so we went. I'm always for comfort, let me tell you. The comfort zone is important. So we go, and it's a little tiny place, just one room, but everything is so perfect. I mean, there's silk on the walls and real silver at all the table settings. And the tables were so close together. You could barely, people had to move so you could get in and sit down.
Wow.
And, but it was a new hot place.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was packed. And so we got there about 5 or 10 minutes early, and he came in exactly on time. And everybody, had to stand up and move so he could weave his way through. And he's a really tall, tall guy. And so he finally sat down. But he was so funny. I mean, he just was a running commentary on everything on the table, which had Himalayan pink salt on everything, under everything. I mean, they served the butter on it. It was just bizarre. And finally, he said to the waiter, because he was asking all these questions, so does the owner of this restaurant own the Himalayan Pink Salt Company? And this young guy just looked at him and went, yes, he does.
How did you know?
I know. The truth was that it never even occurred to me.
Wow.
To own the company. But anyway, he was funny. So, but we were talking, and we were both Scorpios, and we were talking about all these things. And he was going, oh, I can just feel you have healing abilities. And I was going, well, we all have healing abilities. Everything is, And, the whole place was listening to his conversation because it was just quiet in there, and he was, on. So he would bring that up every now and then. And finally we finished, and people were clearing out, and we had our coffee, and we were sitting there, and he just turned to me and he just said, Sandra, I just know you have healing ability. Would you do hands on my knee and pray for me to be healed? I had surgery on my knee and it hurts. And I just looked at him and I thought, oh goodness, you know.
Yeah, okay.
You're in the restaurant.
Yeah, public.
Uh-huh. Yes, and so he just, I was just looking at him, and he turned his chair sideways, pulled his pants leg up past his knee, and so I just did, you know what, you know to do. I did all the little rubbing your hands together, building the energy, making the prayer, focusing the intent, and put my hands on his knees and prayed for him right there in the restaurant. So
did he tell you that it worked?
He said he felt a lot better.
Okay. All right. That's all it takes.
So I said, okay. Yeah. That's what I said. So. Anyway, he was great.
He just sounds like such an amazing person. He's so creative anyway. And I love his stuff. I love his website. And when I saw this in your book, I'm like, oh my gosh, he's also so, in terms of his own spirit, he explores and he's open to everything. I just was, that was nice to see.
It was really nice, because I can tell you other stories about other famous people that are not open, but I won't.
Okay, that's okay. That's okay. Well, let's get into Ingo Swann, because you dropped that name earlier. And Ingo Swann right now is getting some more information out because of the CIA, all of the records that they have just made public, the new batch. And then there's another film coming out, Third Eye Spies, where he features in that. So your experience with him, you got to be buddies.
We did. I didn't even know that there was a new movie coming out that was about what he did.
Yeah, the Third Eye Spies. Yeah, Third Eye Spies is coming out, and they're working on, I just put some stuff on the blog, Wendy's Coffee House. I put some stuff on the blog about that, because I'm going to interview, I already interviewed once the guy who's part of this, and I'm trying to remember what all I have on there. But anyway, yeah, they're hoping he's right now going to be, this month, he's supposed to be taking it around to distributors, trying to pick up somebody to help him get it out. But it's they were finishing up the final in December.
That's cool, man. That man, his life is worth about 10 movies. So interesting, between his art and his psychic ability and his writing. I mean, he was just really phenomenal. And I remember one time he went out to Menninger's, to Elmer Green's place.
Yes.
And it was when Elmer had first created or recreated that the copper room. I don't know if you know about this, what intensifies your meditations or your psychic ability. It's a complicated thing, but he gathered all this information from the Tibetans, and he built this room. And Ingo went out there. Ingo was asked to do everything. You know, whenever anybody would have anything new that they were developing, they would have him come and check it out. When Persinger was doing that God helmet, Ingo went right up there and, you know, gave him his take on it. It was very interesting.
Wow.
This room intensified his experiences so powerfully that, and he was finding it very hard to turn them off. I mean, we would walk down the street on the Bowery where he lived, and he would keep his eyes down, because he would just look up and get all this information from people, everybody that was coming towards him. And it was too much for him. It was just too much. One night we were sitting in a restaurant and, somewhere down there on 9th Street, I guess. We were eating, and I just looked up, and he's across from me crying. And I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "You see those two boys over there that are sitting near us?" I said, "Yes." He said, "They both have AIDS, and they're going to be dead soon." And he said, "I just can't bear that. I can't bear this." And he couldn't. He just could not bear it. And he sort of secluded himself and worked on being able to block this information. But it was really extraordinary. But he made a semblance of this copper wall, copper room, which was, you know, a magnet hanging over your head, and you're sitting on a wooden chair but has no metal in it, and crystals and all of these things, and you're looking into this copper plate of metal. that's not all there was to it, but that's what I can remember right now. But okay. And everyone that came into his house wanted to sit there. And it really and truly just put you into an altered state so quickly that, you know, it was hard to
wow
walk and talk. Yes.
Okay. That I've heard about, but I didn't realize how much it intensified everything.
Yes, very. It is very, very intense. And, you know, I think that it's like anything with drugs or anything, whatever. It's sort of where your level of spirituality is. That sort of guides the experience about what's going to happen to you. Like that experience that I had in the mountains of New Mexico and was that Arizona? No, it was Colorado and Crestone, Colorado. And it really depends on, you know, what chakras are blocked or what energy is moving and how it moves. And so many things that had to do with, you know, who you are at that time.
Yeah.
That really guide the experience, but it was an extraordinary, and he kept it there for a long time, and then he finally put it away. He said, you know, this is, he felt like it just wasn't good for just sort of random people who would just mm-hmm. come and visit him and say, oh, I've heard about this, I want to do it. And I think that that was right for him to
use
that.
I agree. Yeah. This stuff, you really have to be prepared because it throws you, if you have no experience with it, in terms of grounding and working with things like shadow, it can throw you off completely. And I don't know that there's always a way of coming back from that kind of discombobulation.
I know. I have been asked, speaking of that, I have been asked to help this woman's son, and I haven't even met them yet, but she is an official with the UN or whatever, but her son was going to Berkeley, and this is in the last few years, and he took some drug, I don't know what, whether it was LSD or something, but it was some mind-altering drug.
Could have been ayahuasca. And that's the one that's popular right now.
That's true. Yeah, that is probably what it was. You're probably right. And but from that experience, because he was so open to everything, the strangest thing has happened to him. He has disassociated from everything and lives his life as the life that he was living as a Tibetan monk.
Oh, boy,
and
yeah.
He sleeps on the floor. And yeah. He would only eat certain foods, and he prays all the time. And she, you know, he was a college kid,
yeah.
And because they weren't interested or didn't know about anything in this field, they have had him, you know, in all sorts of places and uh-huh. therapy and everything, and nothing has really helped. And now he's just at their house, and they just don't know what to do. And a friend of mine, said, you know, I know this woman who might be able to give you some leads.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, oh, dear. But I mean, I think that is, what you're saying is really true. You really have to be careful about where you are and what you're doing and the effect of it.
Jim Tucker, he's the guy who works with the past life. And is it the University
yes.
of Virginia? Oh,
yes.
I would recommend him. I've tried to get an interview with him, and he's way too busy. But I talked with Leslie Kane recently with her book, and hers is on surviving death. And she talked with him. And to me, that's a good start, because this is a psychological, it's a whole consciousness shift. And there's more than just psychology going on. There's this whole element of him being transplanted. And there's a, transpersonal psychology aspect? What's Mr. Tartt?
Yeah.
Charles Tartt?
Yeah, Charlie Tartt, yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking some of those people will have either, you know, some contact or some information that would help, because this is obviously you're the person for the job. You've gotten run the whole gamut with all the people of the who's who in this industry. But I know when those kinds of things happen, it's mind boggling to people in the normal, you know, reality that this could even happen. And yet this is real. This is part of the stuff they say. Don't mess it with it unless you have a real solid grounding in who you are, because these things, when they happen, you have to have somebody who can help ground you and get you back on your feet, because it just opens you to a whole new reality. We got to take a break. But I do want to come back and talk about that. But I also want to talk about this really, really cool recipe, the orange cake recipe. Okay. Right. We're going to come back. The book, Snapshots, Memories, and Recipes. Sandra Martin is my guest. Got to get the book. All sorts of stuff, fun stuff. Coming up next, a taste experiment. Yummy.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm gonna keep ticking. But no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times, when we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while? Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
There's a natural resource that exists everywhere on the planet which could benefit all of civilization. Yet it's been largely ignored. That resource is women. In many of the world's poorest communities, women are denied a significant role. So often their talent and potential remain untapped. At CARE, we found in country after country that empowering women is one of the fastest ways to improve conditions and help end poverty. That's why CARE is helping provide girls and women with an education, opportunity, and a voice worldwide.
I am powerful.
I am powerful.
I am powerful.
I am powerful.
It's a source of power the world can no longer afford to overlook. She has the power to change her world. You have the power to help her do it. Call 1-800-521-CARE or visit care.org.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
You're so annoying.
You're so annoying.
Stop copying me.
Stop copying me.
Mom, tell her to stop copying me.
Mom, tell her to stop talking to me.
Kids will spend 10 minutes copying everything their sibling says.
You're such a doofus.
You're such a doofus.
How about 2 minutes to brush their teeth? Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. 2 minutes, twice a day. They have the time.
Mom!
A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back. Snapshots, Memories, and Recipes. This is Sandra Martin. And she was a former A-list literary agent, which meant anybody who had a book would contact her and say, okay, this is my book. You need to publish it for me and pay me bunches and bunches of money because I'm really cool. I'm really smart. And I know all sorts of funky new age things. How's that? All right. Well, and she didn't buy all that. Instead, she made people work for the honor of doing that. But while she was doing that, she also fed them occasionally. And there's some recipes in here. squash, Southern style, of course. sweet baked potato or baked sweet potato. These look really good. The cream sweet potatoes with a pineapple. I'm like, whoa, that is dynamite. Okay, but since I was having a birthday and your daughter recommended that orange, wonderful orange chiffon cake, I thought, well, let's do that. And my husband heard me talking about it. He thought it sounded really good. So he starts, he gets to making the cake. All right, so we make the cake on our first go around, take pictures, make it's all lovely and everything. And we're thinking, you know, this is, it's really interesting, but it's a different cake. And it's kind of a, when you touched it, it was just a little bit on tough on the top, okay? But the frosting helped. Frosting helps. So we thought, well, I talked to your daughter and I said, you know, we made round one because her daughter is her birthday is the same month as mine. So it's like a week ahead. So we were taking the trial run on this to see if we could actually do it. And so we talked to her and laughed about, well, the cooking time was off. Our oven probably was, you know, super duper and just overdid it. So we reduced the cooking time and we didn't tell her how long we cooked it. We just said, okay. And we reduced it. It went from 65 minutes to 45 minutes and 45 came out a little bit better. It was really, it made it a big difference. It was more moist. It was beautiful. Took pictures of it again. And then when she had her birthday, Sandra called me. And Sandra, you called. It was really helpful. Apparently there's a typo in the book.
There's a typo in the book. I was making this cake and I was baking it up and I was, you know, laughing about how many years I've made this cake. And actually, I went and looked at the original recipe, which is written in my grandmother's handwriting on a little 3x5 card.
Yeah.
And I had just, when I typed it in, mistyped instead of 35, I put 65 minutes. And that really was bad.
Okay. Well, wait a second, though. For anybody who does this and doesn't see the typo, it's a good flavor. And you know, you just think your oven is a little bit off, but you don't realize it's that far off. You don't realize that. So even when we dropped it back to 45, it was still a good flavor. The oranges, because you're going to have the orange zest in there, and the frosting, it's just kind of a candy type frosting. It goes over the top and it's scrumptious. And we were thinking, well, now that we've done this twice, the third time is going to be fantastic, but we might even want to go with, you know, grapefruits or blackberries or maybe the liqueur for the icing. It was like, whoa, this is cool. But I needed to take a break because the other thing about this cake...
is eating it.
Yeah, it's incredibly rich. Okay, so after two, and my mom helped with one, my husband was really thrilled. He did more of the heavy lifting, but hey, it's definitely there's no bad way to make the cake. I mean, just letting you know, it still tasted good, even though it was a little crisper for the first go round. It was one of those things where, wow, your grandmother did a good job. Grandmother Maud's Orange Chiffon Cake. So when you get the book, that's what this is. And Sandra was kind enough to let me publish it on the blog. So it's Wendy's Coffee House. You just check that out. It's on there under the cake. It's time to eat cake. Bring on the cake. Anyway, that was so fun. But these other recipes in here, they're, you know, where did all of these come along? Was it just as you're looking through thinking, okay, it's time to share and these are my favorites, or was there a specific another method to the madness of the recipes?
I went back and looked through. Oh goodness, I'm hearing feedback there on that. I went and looked through my cookbook that I would write down. Carol came and she really liked this, and so I would do that, make that recipe.
Yeah. Okay.
And, so you know, that's kind of how it came about, sort of, and that matched whatever I was doing. When Jillian came, Jillian's a really good friend, and she came and she just loved everything that was fresh from the ground, you know, from the garden. And so that's really how the recipes came. And if I had a recipe when I had gone out, I would try to remember how they made that, because I really liked being able to make, you know, sort of a fancy take on an ordinary thing. And so it was good. I mean, somebody was telling me the other day that they had the the chicken with the apricots and how great it was and how much her husband loved it and she loved it. And of course, in my mind, I was going, God, I'm going to make that next week.
I know. Oh, that's all right. Well, there's roasted vegetables in here. There's also the old-fashioned soup. There's some really fun recipes that I was looking forward to trying. It's just that one got in the way. And I saw that one, all the other good ones, the good and healthy ones for me, just kind of took a back seat. And that one, fortunately, my birthday was that I had a good excuse. Okay. So like, this will work. Okay, fine. Yeah.
When it's summer, it'll be all of those vegetable ones will be good because the summer, everything will be fresh and out there at the farmers markets and wherever.
There's a story you tell in the book about having dreams when you were a kid and knowing French in your dreams. And this goes back to that Jim Tucker stuff with the reincarnation element and probably why they're telling you that you might be a good resource for the issue that you were talking about earlier. What happened? What happened with that?
Well, I grew up on the farm in Southern Virginia, and my parents had a really good library, but it was really farm life mostly. And I would have these dreams every now and then, and the dream would be very specific. It would always be the same thing. It wouldn't be very long, but it was so powerful that it was almost like I was watching it while I was sleeping, watching and being aware, being lucid. But, at that age, I didn't even know what I was doing. This woman was walking down this hallway, and she had on a long, heavy dress that was a dark velvet, and she was holding something to her, and she's talking to these people that are walking behind her, and it was like during that point I would go, oh, she's speaking French. And so I'm like watching and being a part of this energy, and she's walking along, and in the dream, I know that what she's saying is that these tapestries, are from so-and-so or whatever, and that the king built this home for me, but this will be yours now. That was the sort of end of everything. This will be yours now for the public. And so we went all the way down this long hall, and we went out the door to the left, and we were standing in front of the building, and this plaque that I'm holding to my chest is in big on the side of the building, and it says whatever it says in French. And I have never, ever known what it said. And when I finally did go back to France, I would look for that particular thing. But I would wake up every time going, oh, my God, I can read French too. I would just wake up as a child going, no. And the one time I told my mom about it, she just shushed me as if, oh, get out of here. You just vivid imagination. No. So that was that. So I didn't talk about it. And I would have it maybe once or twice a year for my whole life. And when I moved to New York and I traveled a lot, I just, in New York, you can get all these deals, that would be go to London for a long weekend and airfare, and the hotel would be $400 or something like that.
Wow.
And so I traveled a lot, and I went to conferences everywhere. And so, but it was only after 10 years or so that I was looking at a map, and I realized that I had been in every country around the country of France, but I had never, ever been to France. And people would always ask me, do you want to go? We're going to go to France or whatever. And I had a friend, Emily, who would say, we're going to go with Richard, a client of mine at the time. We're going to go to France, to their house in the country. Don't you want to go? And no. And it was just, I never,
odd.
Never consciously dealt with it.
Yeah,
it
odd.
It was so deep inside that I just thought that was odd.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was towards the end of the 90s, and I was really exhausted after this long life of, 24 hours a day working. And Richard Belzer, who was a client of mine, said, mm-hmm. and he asked me every year, you want to go with me to France? I'm going to go after the homicide, Life on the Streets, and then he was in Law and Order. You know, mm-hmm. We've finished filming, and I'm going to go, don't you want to go? Because it'd be fun, and, you know, we can talk about conspiracies and whatever. And I would always say, yeah, thank you anyway. But 1 year, and this was, I don't even know if I put this in there, but I think it's funny. This was the year that he had finished Homicide, Life on the Streets. He had done a special for Showtime where he did this reenactment of JFK and the being killed going down Dealey Plaza. And I went out there with him while he was doing it because I had a lot of clients out there. Jim Morris was one of my clients. And Jim Morris, mm-hmm. the king of all conspiracy guys for JFK.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so we were out there. And so I ended up playing. They sort of, you know, did the reenactment of it. And so there I am being Mrs. Conley. And I'm in that 63 Lincoln going down Dealey Plaza. It was so eerie. And they were filming it and I'm waving, you know, and it was very strange feeling. And so if you ever watch that, you can see me like for maybe a half a second, maybe 1 second as I'm going by. But if you know what you're looking for, you can see me.
I know. I know. Yeah. Like, okay.
So anyway, so he that year he said, come on and go. And I said, okay, I will. So we flew over from JFK to Paris. Then we went to another plane to, and we went from either De Gaulle to Orly or vice versa. We flew to, I think, Toulouse. I'm not sure. And then we took a train to Rodez. I mean, it was a long, long trip. And then because they really lived in the country. And then his wife picked us up in Rodez, and we went to their house. And it was wonderful. You know, their house is beautiful. It's on an island. It was a grain mill on a little river. I mean, it's really, really right out of Architectural Digest. Uh-huh. And I was there, and we would go and have lunch. We'd do things, you know, just whatever you do when, you know, when you were vacationing.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but I would get this feeling, I need to go to Paris. I need to go to Paris. And I actually, after being in New York City and being so busy every day, all day long, from the moment I woke up until I fell in bed asleep, that I was bored. I was tired and I was bored and I just was tired of just going and having lunch and coming back and looking at the river and going for walks and whatever. So I told Harley and Richard that I wanted to go to Paris, and they were like, oh, no, don't leave. But anyway, they took me to Rodez, a little airport, and I flew to Paris. I got off the plane in Paris, and I got in a taxi to get to a hotel. She knew this little hotel she thought was good. And I just started sobbing, crying. I felt like my heart, my chest was being crushed. Mm-hmm. I was so sad. I just could not bear it. And I was just crying all the way to the hotel. And I would just pull myself together, and I checked into the hotel, and I went up to my room, and I called Lisa to say, you know, this is where I am. This is my number, whatever. And she was, you know, everybody's really wondering if you're having fun and what are you doing and how come you went to Paris and things like that. And I was just trying to get off the phone. And so I got off the phone. And a few minutes later, the phone rang, and it was a friend of a parapsychologist's ex-wife. I didn't know that at the time. I knew nothing about her except that this lovely voice just said, Sandra, you cannot stay in Paris. I will come and get you. We're going to my country house. And I just said, okay, because I could not really stop crying, and I didn't know what it was all about. And so I mean, I was there like 2 hours, 3 hours maybe. And She came and she got me. We got in her little car and we started driving southwest out of Paris to go to her house by the river. And I'm still crying. I'm just crying and crying. And she's just totally oblivious, just like the taxi driver was.
Yeah.
Like, you're crying. It's okay. Don't bother me. I won't bother you. You know, that kind of thing. And she was, she rolled her own little cigarettes. I mean, I was really amazed at what she could do, this woman. She had a little contraption that you put into your, the lighter thing, and she would heat her water. And she had her little tea bag she put in there, and she could put the window down, throw the tea bag out, and put a new one in. Just, she had must have done it 1,000 times or more. And she
wow.
could roll her cigarettes, and it was just, you know, she just didn't want any chemical anything. So she was
yeah.
rolling her own cigarettes and everything. And anyway, so we're leaving. We get out of town, out of the city, and I start to calm down, and things are better and whatever. And we get to her house, and her house is a, you know, really beautiful house that's very soft and comfortable and chintzy fabrics and, you know, cozy.
Uh-huh.
And so we're there, and I found out a lot about her. And, I mean, neither one of us, even to this day, have discussed the fact that I had never met her before, and I got in the car and went off with her.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah.
So, which seems to be something that I have no problem doing. But anyhow,
I was going to say, yeah, yeah, it's kind of a thing with you, like the guy who said, you know,
yeah,
you let me come
yeah.
stay at your house. Here, come on.
Uh-huh. No, pretty bizarre.
That's how you meet people. Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, she was a parapsychologist herself. She was really, really smart. She had her PhD from a university there in France, and was doing all this research, and, you know, was really a brilliant woman. And so she said, you walk along the river and you meditate and work on whatever's happening to you. And, I'm writing a paper. So that's what we would do. And we would go and have lunch in the little town and come back. And that was what we did for like a week. And I just said, I have to go back to Paris. And she said, what is it that are you going through? And so I was like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know anything about France or Paris. And I thought, except that dream I had as a child.
Yeah.
So I told her this long dream and everything that had happened. And she, you know, I was really worried she was going to put it in her research, but she didn't, thank God. So we ended up going back to Paris. And I really believe that that was a past life there, and that I was killed there, beheaded.
Mm-hmm.
And but I walked through Paris for another week, and I just walked and walked and walked, and I cried and I prayed and I just, you know, begged for understanding, and a lot of things came to me that were, you know, in those moments of intense emotional release. And I would just, things would happen and I would go, oh, okay, I got it now. That's what happened. And this is what led to this. And you know, and then why I lost this house, because I had betrayed the king.
Ooh, details.
Big, bad move. But anyway, after that happened, I was going to tell you the other thing that happened that was so interesting was that as soon as I got to the hotel in town, in Paris, I called Lisa again to tell her where I was and what was going on so that she could reach me if she needed to. And within a few minutes, a woman called me and said, you cannot stay in Paris, another woman. And Inga Swann had given her my name and said, call Sandra, she, you know, and take care of her. And it was like, and this emotional, all of these people were plugged into me during that time.
Yeah.
And so I just kept saying, no, 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 I'm going to stay here and work this out. I have to work this out. And so anyway, after all of that, and after the understanding of what had happened to me and how I had obviously not dealt with the sorrow of it, mm-hmm. I have never had that dream since.
See, Yeah, this is a past life stuff. I'll tell you, when I first got into doing this kind of stuff, you talk about that. And the guy who's having the issue with having basically flip-flopped where he is in terms of his life reality. I was working with a massage therapist, which I did for 10 years to help me incorporate some of the stuff that I was going through in terms of a spiritually transformative experience. And we were working at the head, and I have had a birthmark at the back of my neck for years. Didn't think anything of it. During that session, I had a past life memory. And it was the body separating at the time of the decapitation. And I saw what was happening, and I was so appalled and indignant that they could possibly do something like that, that they had to go to that extreme. I was just really, really irritated. But I remember when she was saying, she said, what happened? Because at the time that we were working on this, your head almost fell off. It fell off as she was doing the work. And there were a lot of things that happened with that. My throat chakra opened, a lot of different shifts because of that past life, you know, freeing that little bond that had been trapped. And, you know, I just remember the whole thing of feeling so irritated because I could see the scene. I could see my floating above the body and all that, and remembering all the angst and anxiety that went away when that shifted. Does that make sense?
Yes, because I think that is what happened to me. I think that I just was released from all of that. And afterwards, I went back to Paris many times after that, and I never had another twinge of anything.
Yeah,
Totally,
once it's gone, it's gone. Yeah, and it was so funny because that's where I identified. It was in France. I didn't, you know, have the city, but it was during a certain lifetime in France. And so I have no desire to go there. Just for what it's worth.
So you totally understand that. No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
No.
Thanks. I'm fine.
Anyway, you guys have fun.
I love the pictures. It's great, but a little too close for comfort.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's some things make sense in retrospect, and you just say, okay, yeah, it's what it is. I also wanted to say with your stuff with Elmer Green, he wrote a book, The Ozaki Book of the Dead, and it's an experience.
Yeah.
His reworking out issues with his wife, Alice, as she got dementia and Alzheimer's, and it's a fantastic story. I lived in Topeka, so I'm familiar with Menninger's. I sat outside the door as they brought Margaret Mead, and they said she didn't like children. Now, I don't know if that was true or not. I was doing my work as a teenager, you know, doing the visit on site day. Yeah. And they made me sit outside because I was considered a child. I was really irritated. But I got right outside the door. So anyway, yeah, I was at Menninger's sitting outside the door. My one grand moment being near Margaret Mead. I still have a button. And it's, you know, I think it has to do with, you know, it doesn't take a group, it's a small group of people can make a difference was what the gist of that. And I thought, okay, I've had my Margaret moment. I'll remember that. And maybe someday she'll appreciate me. You know, we're young. We're young.
We are.
We don't know bounds.
Beautiful, innocent then.
So anyway, but your experiences, you have so many people, you could drop so many names and you don't need to. It's just the like Richard Bach, you know, saying that he was there and that when you had this barn experience where you had all these people coming and just a wonderful way of connecting people that you may never know how many people you connected. But I was reading your books. Okay, so I'm so thrilled that you are who you are and you have given us a legacy and getting these people, their work out to a larger audience. So, you know, just to say thank you for all the things and all the people you will never know who you've touched. It's an extraordinary thing that you have done.
I have been grateful every day. And I think maybe after the first two or three years, I realized what an impact, because people would say to me, you know, I've been trying to sell my book and nobody would publish it except these little bitty publishers. And I really wanted a big publisher and, you know, to get this word out and everything. And it just changed things. It was very meaningful to me because the books were meaningful to me. The information, their path, their understanding, their search was part of my life. So it was great.
Well, and part of it is, you know, when you start realizing there are other people out there who are doing this and writing about it, talking about it, living it, then in so many ways, it opens your imagination and your ability to be more creative and more positive, more proactive, and more accepting of some of the quirks and the things that don't make sense now. They don't have to. It's that past life thing that said, oh my gosh, everything fell into place. I didn't know anything about it, but it did make a difference. And that's huge.
Yeah.
You know, so that part of it, when you're doing those things and you're eating cake, it's really makes
life is good that way.
I'm going to have to let you go, but I'm so glad. Thank you. I really appreciate the time with you, and I appreciate the stories that you've shared. And if you're listening, you can go to Lisa, or you can get it at Amazon.com, but Lisa, the book, LisaHaganBooks.com, that way they'll know you've been here.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And I'm going to go make another version of your cake. Okay.
Thank you so much. You're a wonderful person. I'm so grateful I know you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for listening. Right. The recipe is on wendyscoffeehouse.com. All right. So check it out. Read the book, Snapshots, Memories, and Recipes. And make some fabulous food. See ya. Stay curious.